Wednesday. And Harry's faith read the footnote in the Harper's Collins study Bible. I'm telling you this because the children are out of the sanctuary and I'm not preaching on this, but I promise you it will make you go back and read that passage from Mark, because the Harper Collins study Bible says, note the two verses that are left out and note what some of these words stand for, and realize that this passage is about child sexual abuse. We all gasped, and I thought, what an interesting passage to be in the lectionary this Sunday. So when you get tired of my sermon, you can just think about that. Also, when you get tired of my sermon, be sure to read the music notes this week, which I think are very interesting, the way the choir is singing music from two periods in the church's life of where the church, part of the church was invisible. The text is from Numbers. Moses saying, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his spirit in them. On the Sunday when we were unnecessarily worried about finding a parking place in our own parking lot, because of all the pilgrims on their way downtown to catch a glimpse of the humble vicar of Christ, we have before us two stories that turn us, ironically, to consider what God is doing beyond the bounds of the official body of believers to accomplish God's purposes. In both stories, those who have been chosen by God, the 70 elders of the people, it reminds me of a committee here in Philadelphia, I think, named the Committee of 70. That's where it comes from. So the officials chosen by God, 70 elders in the wilderness, and the 12 disciples in Mark's gospel, take issue with the claims. So those have been chosen officially by God, take issue with the claims of those unauthorized to speak or act in God's name. In each lesson, the main character, Moses in Numbers, Jesus in Mark, insists that the outsider is not at all outside what God is doing to make and keep human life human in the world. Therefore, Moses exclaims in response to Joshua's order that Eldad and Medad be stopped, would that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his spirit in all of them. Likewise, Jesus says to John's censure of an unnamed exorcist, whoever is not against us is for us. Whereas Christian ethicist Paul Lehmann once put the matter, after one has laboriously settled the credentials of believing, one always sooner or later is bound to encounter another human being who has never been baptized and appears to be totally unaware of or indifferent to the koinonia, the church, yet who behaves like the Lord's anointed. This may be one of God's happy private arrangements, Laban muses, in order to keep baptism from becoming an advertising campaign. On this week when the church has been everywhere in the news, Christians all over the streets, the questions posed by these stories would seem to be, how are those of us inside the church to respond to those outside the church whose actions appear to embody God's will and whose words sound for all the world like God's address? From the beginning until now, it would seem God's people have been at odds with each other, a sibling rivalry of sorts. The firstborn and the second God's favorite versus God's forgotten children. Yet the invisible church also has to do with the theological understanding of the church that was developed precisely in the midst of divisions and schisms. Therefore, if we are to make sense of the church that exists in hiding throughout all of history, we would do well to begin again in the wilderness, when the community asked of its own, who among us is authorized to speak in God's name? On whom does God's Spirit rest? Officially on the seventh, but unofficially, the Spirit rested on Eldad and Medad, curiously named minor characters, who had not gone out to the tent of meeting to receive a portion of the Spirit, but prophesied nevertheless in the camp. Was the Spirit that rested on them really God's Spirit? Congregations have been divided in God's name, even destroyed by characters claiming to speak for God, who were not. Likewise, the church has been renewed and the church's leadership chastened by unlikely and unauthorized characters speaking God's truth to assumed ecclesial power. God's institutionally authorized spokespersons to respond to God's institutionally unauthorized prophets within the community? Is the church more than the eye can see? Now, the story in Mark involves two communities of Jesus' followers about 35 years after the crucifixion. One was the Jerusalem-centered community represented by the 12, and the other was Mark's Galilean-centered community represented by the unnamed exorcist. Though it is too early in the church's history to speak of orthodoxy, the dynamic tension in the story is between those who believed they were the authorized followers of Jesus and those who are simply doing Christ's work in the world. John whines to Jesus, much like the unnamed young man in Joshua whined to Moses. Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us. Not following us. It is a line repeated endlessly. understanding of the church that refused to be bound by what the human eye could see. The authorized voice in Rome said that the invisible church was a sleight of theological thinking that attempted to secure a place eternally for those estranged from the Roman church temporarily. Undaunted by the critique, Ulrich Zwingli, a Swiss reformer, invited his congregation in Zurich to think of the church as both a visible and an invisible community. Believing that the Spirit of God is not bound to the ordinary means of grace, a very radical thing to say, but that God's Spirit may work when and where and how the Spirit pleases. Zwingli included in the invisible church all the pious heathen and all infants dying in infancy, whether baptized or not. John Calvin went on to speak of the church as both the visibly gathered community, where the word is purely preached, the sacraments rightly celebrated, and the invisibly gathered community of those whom God has called in love through Christ from before the foundation of the world. It was the Reformer's belief in the existence of the invisible church that encouraged them and provided the seed of ferment that opened the visible church to the reforming spirit of God's unbounded grace. In essence, the Reformers reclaimed the belief of the early church, spoken in the second century by Ignatius. Where Christ is, there is the church. Still the question remains, where is Christ? Inside? Outside the church? Both? In particular, Karl Barth would say some 500 years later, Christ is where men and women are disconsolate, knowing they have been banished from Christ's presence. Christ is not and can never be where men and women think they have insured themselves against the anguish of this knowledge. The church is that visibility that forces invisibility upon our eyes, that humanity which directs our attention towards God. As I watch the coverage of the Pope, perhaps it is the Protestant spirit within me, but I would confess that as he is the vicar of Christ, and he is, I see Christ present not so much in the cathedral and the pomp of clerical processions. I see Christ wherever Francis reaches out to touch and bless the least of these, those most likely to be unseen, unheard, forgotten. The child at the airport with cerebral palsy, the aged nun in her wheelchair, the immigrants emboldened by his words, the poor to whom he says bon appetit, the prisoners he is visiting this afternoon in Philadelphia. But the hope of the invisible church gives me eyes to see that Christ is also where I see nothing. And the Pope says, with the women who have the Spirit of God resting upon them no less than the beautifully dressed men, with the families who have not been celebrated with the children in this country whose parents may soon be deported, with the abused whom Jesus addressed in these verses from Mark, counseling the abusers to cut off the offending body parts. In a slightly different twist on the visible and invisible church, Mark speaks of the visible church of Esau, where no miracles occur, and where consequently people are exposed as liars, precisely when they hear and speak about God. And the invisible church of Jacob, where miracle is, and where consequently the truth appears above the deceit of human beings. These two churches do not, of course, stand over against one another as two things. The church of Esau alone is observable, knowable, and possible. It may be seen at Jerusalem, or Rome, or Wittenberg, or Geneva, or Philadelphia. The church of Esau is the realm where failure and corruption may be found, the place where schisms and reformation occur. But the church of Jacob is capable of no less precise definition. It is the unobservable, unknowable, and impossible church, capable neither of expansion nor contraction. It has neither place nor name nor history. Men and women neither communicate with it nor are excommunicated from it. It is simply the free grace of God. It is the beginning and the end. I have a recurring dream, Tim Safford writes, rector of Christ Church downtown, as if he were telling his dream to Pope Francis. At the Sunday Mass on September 27th, I am lost in the crowd, watching the action on the Art Museum steps on a jumbotron. I see you break the Eucharistic bread, symbolizing the body of Christ. You say, all are welcome to God's table, which will mean not just your Roman Catholic flock, but the larger flock that encompasses all of God's children. In my dream, when you give the Eucharistic bread to those around you, the first hands belong to the parents of Michael Brown or Sandra Bland. Then I dream you give the bread to Margie Winders, a lesbian teacher who recently was fired from Walden Mercy for being in a same-sex marriage. Then you share the communion with the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, Catherine Jeffers Scorey, a bishop just like you. Then with a teenager born in our country whose parents may soon be deported. Then I pray with one still struggling to overcome the violence and shame of being sexually abused by a priest in the church. In my dream,